Blog Talk Radio.
My main point here is that none of us should get into this dialogue of my slave master is better than your slave master, inasmuch as all of them were bad. But each one of us had to deal with a given situation, and all of the situations were bad, and all of the situations were humiliating. And none of the slave masters were kind. And none of them did us any favor. And none of them favored one over the other. And understand that the slave ships did not bring any black Americans or any Caribbeans out of Africa. They were only African people. And all of them had to become what the system made them become. And so we have to understand that all of us belong to a collective African family away from home. Then subsequently, we are going to have to go back home or make some kind of contribution to Africans in Africa. All right, that's not my point. That's not the subject for tonight, but it is a subject that we cannot avoid. All right, now, why the emphasis on Africa and the rise of Christianity? And I'll tell you how I came to the subject briefly. Because I learned to read very early, because I wanted to teach Sunday school in a Baptist church, and because I had, I was under the persuasion of a great lady, my great grandmother, one of the great loves of my existence. Because she was devoutly religious, and a believer in the Bible to the point of saying everything in the Bible is true and not to be contradicted. When I found all those white images and went to Grandma, Grandma said, "Shut up, boy. That's God's word." When I mentioned the curse and asked the question, what did we do as a people to get cursed? She rationalized it and said that, well, one day the veil will be lifted and we'll be freed of the curse. I could not deal with this because I had so much faith in her and her deep religious belief that everything in the Bible was true. I had not grown up, of course. I had not read books about how the Bible got written. I did not know at that time how to separate history from Jewish folklore. I did not know that principally the Bible is a Jewish survival book and a very good one, and that some of it is pure history, some of it is pure folklore, but all of it is spirituality. And we must understand, all of it was told as a spiritual story and for the spiritual enhancement of all men. I had not at that time looked at the Egyptian version and the Ethiopian version of the Bible. It was not until the late 30s that I saw an Ethiopian Bible, and in the Ethiopian Bible there was only one white character, and that was the devil. I had not at that time been exposed to all of that or the literature concerning the religions of the world. I saw that Africa was the basis of all the three major world religions. What I want to look at, I want to look at not only Africa as the basis of the world's religions, I want to look at the spirituality of the world of that day before the formal development of these religions, because these religions were developed out of the spirituality that existed at the time, and that the spirituality at the time and the religions at the time was not a weekend thing. It was an all-conclusive thing that it embraced the life of its inheritance. To such an extent, your religion determined your dress, your marriage, your diet, it determined where you lived, it determined the totality of your life. And it was not a partial thing in your life, it was a total thing in your life, as your choice of spirituality supposed to be. Western man made it something that it was never intended to be. Now, my main point is that all of the elements that went into the making of the world's three major religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of the elements existed in Africa 3,000 years before the formal development of these religions. We want to look at these elements and look at these stories. Then we want to deal with the Hebrew interest and to what extent they copied African folklore and made this folklore a part of their history. And the same folklore having existed in Africa for thousands of years before they arrived. Now, what you have to look at also is the fact that we are talking about a period in the history of the world when there was no such thing as Europe. It's hard for you to believe this, and it is hard for you to understand that for most of the existence of the world, for most of the time, man has been functioning in the world, there was no such place as Europe. Now, we're looking at civilizations that existed before the creation of a place in northern Asia called Europe. That is not a continent. What you have to understand is the impact of the glacial age. And the glacial age hit Europe. For most of the existence of these early civilizations, Europe was an ice cap and was uninhabited. It was only after the melting of this ice that people could go into Europe and form a civilization or a way of life. And these first people were Africans. Now, you're wondering, how did they become white? Well, it's a longer story that we can tell. But nature endows man and woman with the covering they need when nature put them down. And nature subtracts from man and woman things that they do not need in the climate and in the environment where nature put them down or where they choose to dwell. All right, now, Christianity developed out of African humanistic values and social thought. These humanistic values and social thought was old in Africa and remained in Africa for thousands of years before someone gave the religion a name. In other words, there was probably more Christianity before someone decided that it should have a name, and they put a name on it. Now, this is reflected in a lot of literature, some written by our own writers, John Jackson's Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth, where he traces the concept of Christ in 26 civilizations, all 1,000 miles apart. In another work, Man, God, and Civilization, and another pamphlet, The African Origins of Christianity, and his new work, only out a few months ago, Christianity Before Christ. Now, the unfortunate thing about a book like Christianity Before Christ is that a lot of people will read the title, be intrigued with the title, and little afraid to read the book. And yet, he has treated the subject with great delicacy and with great respect. All he has done is to point out that all of the elements that ultimately went into the making of Christianity existed in Africa before Christ, and someone
came along and a set of circumstances made man formulize those elements and give it a name. Now that is not disrespectful of the religion at all. It is a tracing of the origins of the religion to African sources, Nile Valley sources, mainly Ethiopia and the nations in the Nile Valley. We're not emphasizing Egypt alone, because Egypt alone was not the producers of this great civilization. A complex of nations in the Nile Valley produced this civilization and produced the religion. The concept of worship and the concept of a single God first appeared in Ethiopia. But the formalization of the concept would later appear in Egypt during the period of Akhenaten. All right, now, my point is that in looking at the religion, we have to look at the history at the same time. And we have to look at some of the literature around it, especially John Jackson's work, Ethiopia and the Origins of Civilization, and the pagan origins of the Christ myth, and other works, including the later work on the African origins of Christianity. All right. He shows also how this religion spread to India, spread to other parts of the world, and took on different names. And these deities appeared under other guises. All right, now, the formalization of these religions, of this religion, and this religion functioning side by side with other religions, brought no conflict at this time in history, none of the conflict that we see today. And we see it first taking shape in Ethiopia and moving down the Nile. In the fortunate circumstance of its birth and its development, before someone gave it a name, if there was no pressure or agitation about it in this setting. There was no Asian, there was no European, and the Africans wasn't fighting over it, and they granted each other the choice of choosing one aspect of it than another. But the Africans had already begun to develop the main aspect that were to go into their spiritual life. An aspect that still goes into African spiritual life. If you visit the villages, you will not see it in the cities, but you will see it today in the villages. And that is bringing life in harmony with nature. And when we look at life today in the Western world is out of harmony with nature. It makes no sense. It makes no sense for one man to have enough bread to feed a multitude and to hold up the multitude. It makes no sense. There's a lack of balance. But Africans had a society where each man gave and each man had according to his needs. Now this was a form of social living that predates the concept of socialism. This is what Karl Marx misunderstood, and this is what the Marxists still misunderstood, and this is what they stupidly call primitive communism. It wasn't primitive at all. It was advanced, and it was Christian. Because they say religion is the opiate of the people, they can't deal with the fact that these early societies in their spirituality was a total thing. And religion wasn't the opiate of the people. Religion was part of the totality of the society and part of the day-by-day spirituality of the society, and it determined everything. It was only in the emptiness of Europe. It was only under feudalism. It was only in the misuse of the church. It was only in this regard, the hustlerism of the European church, that they turned it into the opiate of the people. But religion was never intended to be the opiate of the people. And this is why the European has no understanding of the non-European mind, of the non-European spirituality. These early religions were not hurriedly brought into being or hurriedly changed. They stayed intact for years. So the basic thing about these religions was to create balance. Balance in society. And a respect for the law of God. If you had a God, you had to have a God.
Yes.
Here you had the first female equality. Here you had the first female gods of history. While Hathor is the best known of the early gods, because her influence spread to India, and the concept of the sacred cow started from the worship of Hathor. But the greatest and the most influential of all of the female gods is Maya, who is still worshipped. Now, Europe never had a female spiritual figure. At no time did any female rise to a permanent position in the spirituality of Europe or Islam. I am saying that these Africans had created a society where the fear of the female mind was unknown, and where man was considered to be a balance or unbalanced without female companionship. And where sometimes the God was depicted as being a combination of male and female. Because the totality of man, as they conceived it, consisted of female. Now, this humanistic way of looking at life and looking at people brought into being a concept that is still practiced in Africa, and that is the concept of a matrilineal society. The concept of a society where the lineage comes down through the female side of the family. And most African societies to this day are matrilineal as against patrilineal. And every invader and the last of the massive invaders who tried to change this and succeed in changing it in one part of Africa, especially West, East Coast, would be the Arabs. Now we will talk about this when we talk about African rise of Islam. Then we will also deal with certain segments of the television series The African and certain basic glaring errors so smoothly told that you have a hard time accepting them as errors. Because the man that is narrating it is an absolute master. He has been at the game so long, and he is himself Arab. And he can find that Africa waited in darkness for Islam to bring to life. And he's not the only one, because our word is reflected right here. He is not admitted that when Islam came, Egypt had been great for 1,000 years. And it came to feed on the fallen body of a once great nation.
Yeah.
Of course they brought a new religion. And of course they brought some order in a language. But like all invaders, ultimately they did more harm than good. Now what you need to do is to look at Africa and look at the difference between history and folklore. Let's look at African spirituality in the years before any invader touched African soil. No invaders, no outsiders at all. We're looking at the elements created in Africa that ultimately is going to go into Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. These elements, spiritual elements, created by Africa. And finally, the coming of invaders and what they did. Now, when people say that what they did in Africa, when someone said that they came to Africa and built the pyramids, the people who said they built the pyramids arrived in the 13th dynastic period. Most of the pyramids were built between the 3rd and the 6th dynastic period. They arrived over 1,000 years later. If they say they built bricks without straw, there is no record in African history that bricks were ever built that way. And there's no record where slave labor ever constructed anything as fine as what was constructed in Africa. No. Let's deal with Hebrew myth, a dangerous thing to deal with in and out of the church. All right, they came in the 1700s B.C. Inasmuch as so much of the Bible is involved with Hebrew myth, and so much of Christianity is involved with Hebrew myth, then let us deal with Hebrew myth. They came 1700 B.C. sea, escaping famine, a bunch of hungry people, Western Asian gypsies, looking for a home. They brought no spirituality to Africa. They brought nothing of substance to Africa. They came and they ate. They got the bellies full. They got land. Some of them married African women, Abraham being one of them. Misused her, literally discarded her. In 1680, Africa was invaded by the Hitsa. What position did they take? Did they join their African friends against the first invaders of Africa? No. They joined the invaders. And they rose to high position under the foreign king. Now, I'm not dealing with fiction now, I'm dealing with fact. I'm not dealing with folklore, I'm dealing with fact. They rose to high position under the foreign king. The Hyksos called the Shepherd King. This lasted 150 years, almost 200 years. They produced the world's first wheeler, dealer, politician named Joseph called the Provider. Why could he provide? Because he had the ear of the then remaining king. And he could provide for his people because politically he was entrenched. Then, as the Bible said, Joseph died, his relatives died, and a king emerged, arose, who knew not Joseph. Who is the king who knew not Joseph? Now we have to go to straight history. Who was the king during that period? Part of the period was Seti. But the period of the so-called Exodus, I'm using my words advisedly, the king was Ramesses II. Now there's no record of any pharaoh being drowned chasing any Jews across any water. Now how do I find out? I go on this side of the so-called water, and I study the literature of that day. I find no record. And I go on the other side, and I find no record. No record of that many people departing. No record of that many people arriving. No record spirit. And yet I look at the Ramesses dynasty. It is one of the best recorded dynasties in history. Ramesses stumped his toe and made a record on it. Nefertaria, his favorite wife, the Nubian wife, thought so much of her, he built a tomb, built a temple for her equal to his own. One of the most beautiful temples in the world and one of the finest temples ever erected in memory of a woman. She goes to visit her relatives in the Sudan, Kush. Comes home, he makes a record of it. And yet, 600,000 people depart from this country and there's no record. And what are we dealing with? Folklore? Or we're dealing with facts? nothing wrong with folklore, so long as you know what it is and can separate one thing from the other. Now, if some of you came from the South, we have a character called Hajar the Conqueror. Now, anytime we want something done that we don't have the nerve to do, we assign to Hajar the Conqueror. We start talking, man, did you see Hajar slap that white man's face and he ran like a jackrabbit? Lying like a dog, we know it. Everybody know it. It's folklore. John Henry is folklore. This famous steel diving man. I ran a train. Stories told by John Henry. John Henry was one day old and woke up and people were all having a big feast and John asked him, why nobody fed him? Did the family eat? Yes, John, the family ate. Did you feed the dog? Yes. Am I as good as the dog? Then why don't somebody feed me? It's a total lie. John Henry is a figment of somebody's imagination, but at least we know that. All people tell stories to make themselves feel good, and there's nothing wrong with that, so long as you are clear about what you are doing. The Hebrews copied African stories to make themselves feel good and said, that was us. Then we come down and believe it. When the story of Joseph and Mary, and I've personally seen it, in the great lodge of Luxor, was carved in stone, and the story existed 2,000 years before Abraham arrived. The story of Cain and Abel is an old African story, was an old African story before they got there. And there's a whole book of flood stories. Everybody, every culture has its flood stories. Now, the Bible is not less a Bible and not less holy because it is part fiction, part history, and part folklore. It is still a book of inspiration. It is still a book of spirituality. And you can separate one thing from the other and keep it. I didn't say throw it out. I said understand it. I think you can get more out of it by understanding it. And what I'm saying is that the Hebrews copied African folklore and integrated African folklore into the book, but they personified it, saying this happened to us, when in fact it didn't happen to them at all. They merely said it happened to them. All right, now, when they had to face the Pharaoh, who knew not Joseph, and when he said, those of you who wish to obey African law may stay. Those of you who do not wish to obey African law will have to go. Those are the ones who left Africa. Now that's the origin of it. All the Jews did not leave Africa because some of them said that they could stay and live under African law. Jews remained in Africa. Some of them were there when the Romans arrived thousands of years later. Now, the Exodus is one of the best known stories in human history. And there is not one iota of proof that it occurred. The Bible is not less holy because of it. But this is a part of Hebrew myth. And it is a good story to teach faith. Whether it is true or not, it is a good teaching lesson. What if we draw the lesson from it and start worrying about whether it's true? Now, if you know the geography of Africa, you know that the 16-mile land bridge connecting Africa with Western Asia. When the Jews came in, they walked in. They could have walked out. So they didn't have to leave by water. At all. And if they left by water, they would have to leave further down. And if they left that way, then they would end up in Yemen. It didn't go with the geography. Look at the geography. Look at where the land, this is the furthest Suez Canal. Thousands of years before. Look, the Christian story is one of the most beautiful stories in the history of the world, but you have to separate one thing from the other and keep the story. Don't throw out the story because it is mixed with a whole lot of things that are questionable. You can enhance the story by understanding it and understanding to what extent the story is embellished by folklore. All right, now, 670 people came in. 70 Hebrews came in. 600,000 goes out and still leaves some. Will 70 people create that many people, even if they spent all time creating people? So what we have here is that a lot of Africans, not ethnically Hebrew, became converted to the faith. And they were of another religious persuasion, but not of another ethnic persuasion. And then, at this time, religion was so sharp in the minds of each people, sometimes a religious person, one religion, didn't feel as safe as he thought he should, though religious tolerance was much better then than it is now. All right, now, what did they take out of Africa? They came into Africa without a clear language, without a clear religion, and without a clear culture. When they left, they had all three. Africa had made the Hebrews a people. The early Hebrews became a people and entered history through Africa. And you do not have to argue about whether they were white, black, or otherwise. The only whites who entered the area for Greece and Roman.
All right.
So now you want to figure out where the white Jew came from? That's the problem. The European white Hebrew is nothing but a European belatedly converted to the faith. In the 12th century, A.D., there was arguments in Europe because the Africans and the Arabs were controlling Spain and the Mediterranean. There was arguments for whose fight you're going to join, the Arabs or the Christians. And there was a group of people who didn't want to join either one of them. They sought an alternative, and they chose Judaism. So the Caucasian Jew, just a European who chose Judaism, and he has no ethnic relationship to the biblical Jew at all. Amen. there is no proof in existence that any of the biblical Jews were white. Any at all. Now, what you have to deal with in dealing with the Hebrew myth is with all they took out of Africa, with all they did in Africa, it's after the so-called Exodus, with the destruction of the Canaanites, when they went to Babylonia, they looked over that history and rewrote that history to justify what they had done to the Canaanites. So they had to make the Canaanites villains. And so their God Yahweh had to indulge it. And he said, when they went to slay the Canaanites, came back, have you slain all the Canaanites? Yes, have you slain all the Canaanites? Have you slain that dog? No, go back and slay that dog. So now you see the revenge motive, the vindictive motive, integrated into the religion. The Europeans will adopt that with no appreciable understanding of that. But there is no time in our history, if anybody knows anything to the contrary, let me know. There is no time in our history where they have been on our side in any great crisis of our life. And there's no time when they have hesitated to join our enemies when it was to their benefit to do so. We took them into Spain, and when we lost power in Spain, they helped join to found the Dutch East India Company. They were brokers, insurance brokers in the slave trade, especially the ships in this country. They went to South America, they went the way of, when the Western world swung towards slavery and swung against us, they were just as much a part of our Holocaust as anybody else. And still are. Now this happens to be the documented truth, in spite of the mythology to the contrary, that they have suffered too. But that suffering was a family fight between whites and whites, and not people being taken from their home. All right, now we can leave this part, and while dealing with the history before the formal development of the religion. Religions, all religions, are born in a particular atmosphere in history. And if you look at the atmosphere, you will find there's a demolition and rainfall, there's a particular kind of weather, there's a particular kind of atmosphere that sets people to wondering about old gods and searching for new gods on the eve of the birth of every great religion. So there is a catastrophe or some event that set man's mind in motion and that prepares man for the coming into being of a new religion. Now, when these invaders had hit Africa, and when one after the other had not so much as challenged the spirituality of Africa, but had driven away some of the key priests of Africa, Africans began to have questions. And one of the most disastrous of these invasions was the invasion by a king named Cambyses, 550 BC, from Iran.
after the invasion by the Assyrians. Now, this brought on Alexander, the so-called Great. But after Alexander, the Romans began to covet a city called Carthage. And the Romans desired to control the trade of Carthage, eventually led to the destruction of the city. I'm coming to Christianity. You might think I'm away from the subject, but I'm not. The Roman tax collecting, Roman brutality, Roman rule in North Africa and in Western Asia made the Africans and the Asians question old God and seek new God. So the Romans played a major role in bringing into being the African concept of Christianity that was later developed into a Western concept of Christianity. But the Western concept of Christianity is not even Christian at all. It is a political mechanism called Christendom. And don't get it confused with Christianity, because it's not Christianity. The European wouldn't even dare practice Christianity, or democracy even. It's against its temperament. Now, when the Roman tax collecting and brutality began to make people look into that folklore, the story about a Messiah, the story about a child born in a manger, all of these were folk stories that existed before the child was born and before the coming of the Messiah. Now, they would place human beings bodily inside of those stories, and they would identify a child being born and said, that's the one we expect. Whether it was the one or not, that's neither here nor there. But that's the one they were willing to accept as the one. If that's the one they were willing to accept as the one, then that was the one for them. So they settled it. And they settled it for the age. All right, they identified that. All right, now we take the story of Joseph and Mary. Why were they going to be counted? Roman tax collecting again. They were going to be counted so the Romans would know how many heads to tax in every town and every village. So the story of Joseph and Mary is a tax story, a Roman tax story. And then the brutality of Roman tax collecting drove people to seek a new religion and to seek a Messiah. Now that it is done, the child has been born, the people's attention turns partly away from the event, but the people's attention has to be paid to the fact that they are occupied by Rome. They're under Roman domination. The Romans laugh at this new manifestation of a new religion. They're still hanging out with Zeus. This is their god. Breathe thunder. And glorify murder. Hitler called for the return of Zeus. He said he wanted a god more suitable to the temperament of the Germans. And he was right. God who breathed fire more suited to the temperament of white people, because that's what they try to do. Breathe fire. Christianity is at odds with that temperament. Was from the beginning, still is. You can be Christians. You were Christians before Christ, because you created a society where the temperament was in keeping with the spirituality of the religion. You can't rob people. You can't bomb people's cities. You can't threaten people with atomic bombs and be Christian or Democratic. And you can't do this and say you created a civilization because your act is uncivil. Roman rule continues. Now, for 200 years, the Romans laughed at people in this religion and began to entertain each other by killing Christians. Now, inasmuch as there were many preachers preaching and calling for a new faith at the time of Christ, and he had the smallest number of followers of them all, why is it that we have forgotten all the others, and why do we remember this one? The story is well preserved. The story is well told. And besides, it is a beautiful story. It is a story that has high drama. It is a great mother story. It is a great friendship story. It is a great betrayal story. It has all the elements of lasting drama. You can't help but remember it. No matter what religion you belong to, the story is fascinating. And it is spiritually rewarding. When you think of what is this man up against, but I'm going too far now, I'm going too fast. Let us look at the years before his reemergence, his lost years. Were they lost at all? I choose to say no. There were no lost years. No more than there were lost books of the Bible. Where did he go during these lost years? Obviously studying in the great mystic schools of Egypt. Because he came back preaching a doctrine, preaching a concept of life that resembled the same concept coming out of the mystery schools of Egypt. And once you are trained in that school, you'd rather die than give up your belief. And that's the kind of belief he brought back. Now, coming back with that belief, he ran afoul his own people. And his own people, then under Roman rule, took him to the Roman governor for trial. Now it's a drama. The Roman governor did not see him as an enemy of Rome. In fact, he was doing Roman work unconsciously. He wasn't telling Romans to turn the other cheek, tell his own people. He wasn't driving Romans out of the temple, driving his own people. He wasn't preaching to Romans, he was preaching to his own people, a small Jewish sect. So the Romans did not see him as their enemy and did not want to try him at all. So now, when Pontius Pilate pushes him back to the people and says, "Me is your king," and the people, "It's not my king." Now you know where the story lies. Look at the sadness of it. This is one of our sons. He's gone away and studied in a distant land. And he's learned some things they don't want to hear. A trading people, and he's driving money changers out of the temple. Burma's going way mad crazy. How can people go mad? Now they're taking him before a Roman, a foreign ruler, colonialist, trying to put him on trial. The Roman ruler don't want to put him on trial. They want to wash his hands of the whole thing. When they push him back to the people, not my people. When they declare an armistice, he still want to get out of it. Pontius Pilate still wants to get out of it. Declare an armistice. Anybody want somebody freed or liberated from any crime, shout that name out. Did anybody shout his name? No. Mother? What happened to the disciples? Nobody shouted his name? You think 12 disciples could form a chorus at least shout and say, free him? Whose name did they shout out? Barabbas. A romantic thief. Now you can see how the story lives. It lives in its sadness. It lives in its betrayal. It lives in its loneliness. You can remember that. If these things happen to the other preachers, no one put it down. No one dramatized it and left it for us to go over again and again. We feel a tug at our hearts. Why is this? But nobody helps this man. Now he goes up the hill to Calvary. All those people, and he's initiated, weak, struggling with the cross. Nobody helps him. Then who comes out to help him? Simon of Cyrene. And who's Simon of Cyrene? An Ethiopian. Look at the symbol. An Ethiopian, on his day off, a servant. On his day off. She's minding her own business, give her a rest. We know law against helping a man up to carry with the cross. Anybody could have helped him. What good were the disciples? They didn't help. Now, I don't want to sound like a frustrated Baptist preacher who never made it, but that's probably the point. But I want to show you that this is a story that's worth some serious consideration. You want to know what is the staying power of this religion. The staying power is in the drama. It's in the magnificence of the story itself. Whether you believe it or whether you are of this faith or not of this faith, that's enough to attract you if you read the story of its development. All right, now, he is crucified. Then, allegedly, the body is taken from the cave. Now, in all gods of the world, no one ever finds a grave. No one found Muhammad's grave. No, you don't find the graves of gods. That's a rule. That's a rule of some universal. They ascend or disappear. That creates a permanent mystery around them. That's how they remain God. The element of mystery is there forever. All right, now, the teaching continued. The Romans continued to persecute Christians and continued to laugh at them as being weak. But what you have forgotten and what has not been well recorded is that the literature of the Roman arena has been recorded. But the literature of the African Christian being killed in the amphitheaters of North Africa has not been recorded. Then, finally, one day a Roman emperor looked down in the arena and saw his uncle, John the Christian, willing to die for the faith. And said, well, he's crazy anyway, so let him know. Next weekend, he looked out and saw his wife and child. So stop the show. If this religion has taken on to the point where it has invaded my family, then it requires some investigation. Now he's wondering what to do with this religion. In the meantime, a degenerate emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire who never joined the church, Constantine, began to call councils to examine the faith. He would make Christianity the official religion of the Eastern Roman Empire, and subsequently it became the religion of the whole Roman Empire. Now the political Roman Empire is dead, and the Holy Roman Empire has stopped. The assumption was that Christianity would halt the decline of the Roman Empire. It did not. It hurried the decline of the Roman Empire because the religion was then and still is at odds with the temperament of the European. He could not live and hold power or trample over people the way he does and obey a religion of that sort. And still can't do it. Now, he's facing this conflict with the religion. He is publicizing the fact that he is invincible. Now, St. Augustine, the African father of the church, is appraising the religion after the councils set up by Constantine. It was not just one meeting at Nicaea. Several meetings at Nicaea, but the first one, 332 AD. But after this, these councils, the Romans are already weak, but adopting the religion as a crutch, trying to hold on to Roman domination. They were so weak earlier, they had appointed an African emperor of Rome, Septimus Sabinus. There were several African emperors, Caracalla being one of the last and the most colorful. Septimus Sabinus, 198 AD. He was the ruler of England as well as Rome. He was the one that said that the British were so bad with them. They won't even make good slaves. He thought they were hopeless. Utterly hopeless. He believed in the soul food of that day because he couldn't stand British food. I can understand that now. We took us to African cooks and kitchens with it. You know, having food properly prepared and soul food of that day. But now, when the church became weak again, even before St. Augustine and after St. Augustine, the Romans appointed African popes, three African popes. The one that we need to remember now, because I think if he was around now, he'd be having some difficulty, Tertullian. A great writer, he was the one that coined the phrase, vanity, vanity, thy name is woman. He'd have his head, he'd pull that now. But while the African popes headed the church, the Romans ruled the popes. The consuls ruled the popes. Now, Rome is continuing the mismanagement of the religion. Rome has declared war on the African Christian for the control of the religion. Because Europeans want to control every facet of power, no matter what they say they believe politically, they want to control. And everything that comes from the Europeans' mind meant to facilitate European control over the world. And if you understood this, you'd understand Marxism. It's just another element of European control. And if you want a Marxism that's not under European control, then you will create it yourself out of African communalism and African socialism, as again created African socialism out of African socialism. Created socialism out of African socialism that was far more pure than anything Karl Marx ever advocated anyway. Now, I'm not against socialism, but I'm getting an artificiality of it, because African socialism was closer to Christianity. Actually, he actually did what Marx advocated. He actually did. This is why there was no feudalism in Africa, because land was the collective property of all people, and nothing that could be deeded to any one people, any one person, at the expense of the other. All right, now, I'm trying to wind it down, but what you have to understand is that the continuous Roman mismanagement in North Africa led to massive killing, because the Romans had such killer instinct. They not only violated Christianity, they violated basic elementary decency. They killed the animal life needlessly until the food supply was gone. And when they destroyed Carthage, they plowed salt into the earth so the plants wouldn't grow. That was the Asian orange of that day. And that the killer incident in the European has always been there and is still there. But the Romans continued until about 450, a group of Germanic people called Vandals hit the Roman Empire. The Romans had spread propaganda that they were invincible militarily. But what they forgot about the Vandals is that the Vandals not only didn't read the propaganda, couldn't read anyway. And the Vandals, after the Vandals hit the Romans was nothing military. They joined the Goths and the Visigoths in Spain and came back and hit the Roman Empire, and it was nothing. And they added a word to the language, vandalism, destroy everything. That's where the word came from. The period of the Vandals, so the period of the decline of the Holy Roman Empire and the mismanagement of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, with war declared on the African Christians and the African Christian leadership, with the priests of Europe, with the priests of Egypt, now out of commission or out period, with Manetho, the last of the great priests who wrote the chronologies of Egypt, dead, he began to mislead the Romans at the end anyway, because he gets tired of them misusing the history of his people. With this gone, that a war started between Byzantium, the Eastern Roman Empire, and the regular Roman Empire. This war and the mismanagement of the religion and the misuse of the religion wrecked the structure of North Africa. And finally, a camel boy delivering goods between Damascus and other ports call for reform and having failed to get reform, call for a new religion. That new religion, Islam, with African military might, particularly Zayd bin Harith and Bilal, and with the help of Ethiopia, drove the Europeans back into Europe, where they went into what they call the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages. But this new force in the world would stay the hand of Europe for 1,000 years. And the Africans joined this new force that was good and bad. Christianity had been born by the Africans in peace, in love, and in decency, and great spirituality. The Europeans just took it over and had killed its true meaning and opened the door for a new religion. And I'm saying that both Islam and Christianity need to be examined in this regard, because it will be the role of the African and the role of the African alone not only to give the world a new spirituality and a new religion, but to give the world a new humanity and a new direction. And to do this, the African must restore his confidence in himself and realize what he has done in order to realize what he still must do.